Hello, and welcome to this episode of Our Bodies, Our Stories.
Today, we have a super important topic that we want to discuss, the intersection of environmental justice and reproductive justice.
It's definitely a conversation that needs to be had more often.
Yeah, for sure. It affects the lives of countless individuals and communities, specifically communities of color and economically marginalized groups.
So let's begin by actually understanding what these two terms mean.
Environmental justice is all about fair treatment and meaningful involvement of people, regardless of their race, color, or income, in environmental decisions and policies.
Yeah, and it also focuses on and addresses the disproportionate burden of pollution and environmental hazards on marginalized communities, especially those of color.
Exactly. And as we've discussed already in previous episodes, reproductive justice is a broader framework that goes beyond just access to abortion. It recognizes that everyone should have the right to make decisions about their own bodies and reproduction.
Right, and this means that this choice must be free from coercion or limitations imposed by environmental injustices.
Exactly. When landfills, incinerators, and hazardous waste disposal facilities are disproportionately located in communities of color, that's not environmental justice. These communities face the heartbreaking reality of having to choose between raising their children in a polluted and unsafe environment or not having children at all.
And that, it doesn't just end there. The pollution and climate hazards in these areas make pregnancies and fetal development riskier. Pregnant people who live close to oil and gas wells or chemical factories, for example, have a higher likelihood of high-risk pregnancies and premature births.
Yeah, and it just goes to show how interconnected reproductive and environmental justice are. It would be impossible to talk about one without thinking of and addressing the other.
The environments in which we live, work, and play directly impact our reproductive health and choices.
Exactly. And it's not just about this affecting people's choice, but also about the health of a fetus and the birthing person during and after reproduction.
Yeah, definitely. As I said before, people are affected when the fossil fuel systems, oil and gas wells, chemical plants, and others discharge climate pollution into the atmosphere.
Yeah, and the statistics are alarming. Black, Indigenous, and other pregnant people of color are disproportionately exposed to heat islands and excessive heat, much like they are to pollution.
Yeah, I mean, look at Louisiana's Cancer Alley. The effect of toxic pollutants in this area of southeastern Louisiana is so bad that the entire place is literally referred to as the Cancer Alley.
Yeah, and in this Cancer Alley, there's a predominantly Black elementary school where young children are being exposed to dangerous carcinogens at rates that are 11 times higher than what is considered acceptable by the EPA. And according to estimates by ProPublica, in some parts of Cancer Alley, the lifetime risk of cancer is 47 times higher than what the EPA deems acceptable.
Yeah, and a 2007 study found that a Black child's risk of lead poisoning from exposure to a garbage site is 5 times higher than that of a white child. And this isn't just about economic class. Even well-off Black families are more likely than low-income white families to reside close to a landfill.
Yeah, and although we don't have a concrete reason as to why, one possible explanation could be that real estate agents and implicit biases that these real estate agents have. You know, maybe a Black family comes to buy a house and they come to a real estate agent and they're saying, hey, I'm in the market for a house. And the real estate agent just inherently puts them in a community that is predominantly of color and therefore next to a landfill site. You know, like, how are these things intersecting?
I didn't think of that, but that definitely would be a possible explanation. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's not just the real estate agents themselves, but also the institutions that they work for that propagate these ideals.
Yeah, exactly. And it just keeps getting worse from like, they're like, Black Americans have exposure to 56% more of pollution than is produced by them. And on the other, white Americans are exposed to and consume 17% less pollution than they produce. Similarly, Latin Americans are exposed to 63% more pollution than is produced by them.
According to an EPA report, Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans between 2006 and 2008 had the highest percentage of populations living in areas that did not meet the EPA standards for particulate matter and ozone.
Yeah, and think of it, the entire U.S. Pacific Island region. This spans over 2,000 different islands. The local communities here will be affected by rising sea levels, changing rain patterns, droughts, storms, extreme temperatures, recently fires, you know, all while climate change deniers will provide little to no relief for them.
It's so disturbing to think about this disproportionate distribution. And then it's not just within the United States. Even globally, you can see a similar pattern. According to the Center for Global Development, developed nations are responsible for 79% of historical carbon emissions.
That's insane. And according to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, lesser developed countries were estimated to account for about 1.1% of total carbon emissions from fossil fuel combustion and industrial processes, the main sources of greenhouse gas emissions globally.
And while we use this economic term, like lesser developed countries, I think it's important to remember that most of the times, lesser development in a country is a result of war, capitalism, and exploitation.
Yeah. Recently, in one of my classes, we were reading an article about white supremacy and about how it plays out in these colonial settings and how it almost becomes like a justification for it, of like, we became like, taking the United States, for example, the United States became a superpower on the backs of enslaved people in unpaid labor. And then later people are like, hey, that wasn't really right. The US is kind of like, dang, but look where I'm at. You know, it becomes almost a justification. It's like a feedback cycle because like, well, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. Like, actually,
no, it wasn't your bootstraps.
It wasn't your boots. You don't even have boots. Like,
Yeah. No, and it's definitely interesting to consider what we think of today as development, because who defines that and how do we get there?
Yeah, and all of the development models sort of are Eurocentric, like specifically Europe and the United States, and they assume this is how these countries developed. So this is how all countries must develop the exact same way. So if you aren't developed like us, then you aren't developed. And I don't think that's always the case.
Yeah. Because,
but anyways, so circling back, it's just sort of as we were talking about, it's just important to acknowledge that these circumstances are basically a global extension of the environmental racism that we are discussing.
Yeah. According to 2019 data, the carbon footprint was 23 times higher for an individual in a developed country as compared to an LDC. And yet, over the last 50 years, 70% of worldwide deaths caused by climate-related disasters occurred. And do you want to take a guess?
Could it be lesser developed countries?
Oh my god, you're right.
Yeah, and in a 2019 report released by Durham and Lancaster University, they found that the U.S. military to be one of the largest climate polluters in history, consuming more liquid fuels and emitting more carbon dioxide equivalents than most countries. Can you imagine the U.S. military alone, just the U.S. military, not even the whole United States, just the U.S. military produces 59 million tons of carbon dioxide compared to the country of Bhutan, where the entire country produces 1.6 million tons of carbon dioxide.
That's 36 times less than just the military of the United States. And I get that the country is smaller, so overall, proportionally, it would produce a slightly lesser amount of carbon dioxide, but this is just the military.
This is just our military. And I feel like racism has also played a significant role in perpetuating the belief that there are not enough resources to sustain population growth in economically disadvantaged countries populated by people of color.
In reality, it's often the exploitation of these nations resourced by wealthier and more powerful countries that leads to resource scarcity.
Right, and that is also a reproductive injustice, because now they do not have the economic or environmental conditions to safely raise a child if they want to.
Exactly. Blaming climate change on overpopulation perpetuates the myth that birthing people in poorer countries, which are primarily made up of people of color, should be restricted and have their choice taken away.
Yeah, it's similar to when people in the U.S. say that limiting immigration is the solution to environmental problems. Like, no, that's it's so untrue, and this has no actual basis or facts to back it up.
The problem here is not the amount of resources, but rather the distribution of these resources. Excessive wealth and hyperconsumption contribute much more towards climate change than quote unquote overpopulation.
Exactly. Individuals in the top 1% of the population wealth index emit 70 times more carbon dioxide than the bottom 50% combined.
Yeah, population control is not rooted in facts. It's rooted in anti-choice sentiments, eco-fascism, and immigration and Yeah, population control is not rooted in facts. It's rooted in anti-choice sentiments, eco-fascism, anti-immigration, and frankly, eugenics.
No, I agree, especially when like the majority of the po pollution today is from celebrities, their private jets, and large corporations.
Yeah.
However, there are some, this cannot be a blanket statement for all celebrities. For example, Coldplay is slaying, and they installed kinetic dance floors that help to generate energy to power the show through audience movement during their most recent 2022 world tour.
That's so cool.
No, yeah, and they also use rechargeable show batteries, and these batteries are going to be powered using the innovative electricity producing dance floors, where the kinetic flooring converts the audience feet movements into energy, and by fans pedaling the electricity generating bikes.
That's so cool. And they're also taking steps to maximize water efficiency, cut wastes, and encourage recycling at each of their shows. For example, fans are able to drink free water by carrying their own reusable water bottles instead of giving out plastic bottles, which is so sustainable. And also, there's this app that you can download to track your carbon footprint from the time you leave for the Coldplay concert to the time when you come back. And fans who have less carbon footprint get discount codes, and the amount of carbon footprint that fans produce will be offset by the band themselves. So they're
No.
taking accountability not just for their own show, but also for that of their fans, because they have the ability to, they're in a position to, they can do it without much. Like, I think it's important when we talk about environmental problems and climate change to understand that not everyone can afford
Yeah. It's not all
to have access to the same stuff. Like, not everyone can afford
an
to
electric
buy
vehicle.
an electric vehicle or to buy oat milk for like $10 when regular
Yeah.
milk is so much cheaper.
Yeah. And also, I feel like circling back to just sort of like celebrities, you know, Coldplay was accounting for their fans, but I also feel like Coldplay is not the biggest band out there. There are
Coldplay's pretty
artists,
big.
Coldplay is pretty big, but there are also other artists that are equally as big, if not bigger. I realize for smaller bands, this would be a lot more difficult to do, but there are a lot of artists right now that are going on tour and are not doing any of this to offset their
Yeah.
emissions. You know, let alone the light pollution, that was a little bit harder to offset, but like from the jets, from the taking the stage from
Yeah.
one concert venue to the
If you're in a
next.
position to do that, to make a significant, like extremely significant change, and you're not,
Yeah,
it's disappointing.
it is, I think that's the perfect word to describe
Yeah.
it, especially when I feel a lot of celebrities and artists that are going on tours have the ability and the
And they claim
financial.
to care about these problems. Like,
Yeah. And but here you are, you know, flying around the world in your private jet, you're doing all these concert venues that are taking a lot of electricity that people are traveling to go to, that you're undoubtedly giving out a lot of plastic single-use bottles. Like there are way, if nothing else, Coldplay sets a great example that shows if there are ways around this to do a environmentally friendly concert.
Or at least relatively environmentally friendly.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think there's just so many misconceptions about the environment, what we can and can't do to mitigate the impacts of climate change. And I think the first thing that's important for every individual is just to educate ourselves about what is fact and what is a myth.
Exactly. And while we're talking about misconceptions, I also think it's really important that we address the intersection of birth control and environmental damage. People have blamed the recent excess estrogen in water on birth control medication, and people are using that as a justification to be against it.
That's ridiculous because the data says otherwise. Contraceptives only contribute 1% of the total quantity of estrogen excreted by humans. It's industrial farming practices that are responsible for 90% of the hormones found in the water supply.
Yeah, exactly. And let's not forget that contraceptive use enables families to invest more in each kid by enabling longer intervals between pregnancies and considerably increasing the maternal and fetal health.
Yeah, and that's so important to remember because reproductive justice isn't just about limiting giving birth, but rather actually empowering birthing people to make their own choices and decisions about how their family can thrive.
You're completely right. And I also think when it comes to environmental justice, it is it it isn't as much individual choices that harm the environment, but rather the underlying systemic causes.
Yeah, when given access to education and when someone's socioeconomic conditions improve, birthing people willingly decide to reduce the number of children that they have. Studies have also shown that when women are more confident that their children will live into infancy, birth rates decline.
Yeah, and that's why it's important to tackle these problems at the systemic level.
Yeah, it's always easiest to find different groups of people to blame, but it's time we turn our attention towards reviving collective life and community advocacy.
Exactly. And so also, let's also talk about solutions. There are several things that we can do to support both environmental justice and reproductive justice.
I think today's media focuses on climate advocacy as things happening at the United Nations or the COP27 at the national government level. But I think it's so important to remember and acknowledge the way that so many local indigenous communities and cultures have always been at the center of the climate justice movement.
And a great example is Vela's very own origin story. Vela started as a small group of Vietnamese American leaders who organized to stop the dumping of toxic construction materials in the post-Katrina city rebuilding. These young leaders emerged from the historic low socioeconomic status of Vietnamese refugee community, and they brought about so much change and are still around today.
Yeah, and that was a catalyst for everything Vela does today. It demonstrated the power of cross-cultural intergenerational collaboration, and it was this that empowers us today at Vela to tell our own stories exactly how we want to tell them.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that however helpless and powerless we may feel, together we can create significant change. And to go back to what you said about Indigenous cultures, representation is of the utmost importance.
It reminds me of something Alexia Leclerc, who is an environmental justice organizer, said. They said that Buddhist, Hakka, and Aboriginal Taiwanese cosmologies have always played a key role in their understanding of environmentalism and in shaping her activism. But growing up in Texas, they rarely saw Asian Pacific climate leaders reflected in textbooks, stories, and media. Instead, she was shown white scientists seeking to protect polar bears from extinction.
Yeah, I think it's so important to break away from this sort of white male scientist narrative when it comes to saving our planet. It's almost ironic to see how Asian Americans are often left out of the climate justice movement. When, as Alexia says, as we work towards global climate solutions, we need to learn from the traditional knowledge of the Asian communities and their centuries of experiencing fighting colonialism, capitalism, and the climate crisis.
Yeah, most of the times grassroots action taken by communities can be more beneficial than waiting for governments and international bodies to enforce legislation.
Right, because governments often have a pattern of corporate approaches in dismissing the expertise of locals. They always tend to delegitimize Indigenous science and community knowledge.
And in reality, Indigenous communities have always been at the forefront of this movement. Like Indonesian and Dayak climate activist Latania Jandam said, quote, "We believe that ourselves and our forest are like a joint entity instead of two separate things. It's really important for the Dayak people to be at the forefront of the forest protection and any negotiations and policies that have to do with our territories," unquote.
Yeah. If we all treated our environments with the same love and care that the Indigenous communities do, we would be in a better place right now.
So keeping in mind that Indigenous cultures and practices must be centered when talking about climate justice, Let's talk about what we in our positions today can do.
Yeah, and to begin with, it sounds very simple, but it is also very important. The first and most important task is really just to look out for the environment. It is beautiful and worthy of our love and care.
Yeah, definitely. Another thing would be to listen. Just listen to and prioritize those living in marginalized communities.
Yeah, the United States is kind of infamous for ignoring the voices of BIPOC communities for far too long and far too often when those voices are the ones that we should be listening to the most.
And going off of that, it's important that we educate ourselves and start conversations about environmental racism. It is the same communities of people worst impacted by reproductive injustice that are also impacted by environmental injustice.
Exactly. Not enough people are actually aware of this problem.
And you can't fight against an issue that you don't know exists.
Exactly. And, you know, for those that can, you know, to our listeners, donate, protest, speak with local government representatives if you are in a position to do so. Take any action you can, whether it's big or small. but don't remain silent. Be a part of the change this planet needs by using your voice.
Especially if you're in Louisiana, one of the ways you can contribute is by learning and taking action about the Formosa plastic plant.
To give you a little background, the Formosa Plastics wants to build a massive factory on the banks of the Mississippi River in St. James, Louisiana.
This is the same region occupied by primarily the African American community that already suffers the harmful effects of Cancer Alley that we spoke about earlier. In fact, the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights condemned the project, citing it as a massive human rights violation. It is imperative that we take action.
To find simple ways to get involved, you can sign a petition or email legislators. We recommend that you go to the website stopformosa.org. So that's STOPFORMOSA.org.
Yeah, definitely. And since we're talking about environmental degradation, I kind of want to use this as an opportunity to address excessive consumerism and fast fashion.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I'm a fast fashion hater. And I think it's so important to highlight when talking about environmental justice. And this fast fashion alone could probably have its own episode.
No, that's so true. But just to give a brief little PSA to everyone listening, those $200 Shein hauls are destroying the environment, quite literally.
100%. And fast fashion is honestly a quite recent phenomenon. And before we talk about why it's problematic, let's dive into how it started in the first place.
Yeah, fast fashion emerged in response to increasing consumer demand for trendy clothing, but it's important to remember that often consumer demand is not a result of genuine need or even want, but rather capitalism and advertising that incentivizes us to purchase things we don't need and frankly never thought we needed before we saw that advertisement. It's a business model that prioritizes quick and cheap production, allowing for frequent turnover of styles.
Yeah, and it's not about meeting the needs equitably. It's about encouraging throwaway culture, which is caused by mass consumerism and overconsumption.
And when you think about fashion trends and eras, just think about like, oh, fashion of the 60s, of the 70s, of the 90s. We think about those long decades as entire periods of fashion.
Yeah.
Why are we now changing trends every 2 weeks?
No, yeah, exactly. Like the sweater, like the crop sweater vest in, were in like a year ago, and now they're totally out. You're not supposed to be wearing that anymore. And I feel like that could have been something that could have been a decade-long thing. But with these fast turnovers and the ability to get new clothes for cheap prices that are, even if they're horribly made, the ability to get that so quickly, I think, is very incentivizing for a lot of people.
Fast fashion depletes natural resources on a massive scale, consuming vast amounts of water, energy, and raw materials. And it also generates a staggering amount of waste.
Yeah, in 2022, Shein was named the most popular fashion brand. So let's talk about why this is so problematic. To begin, every day Shein lists 2,000 to 10,000 items on their website. Only 6% of these designs stay on for more than 90 days. Then this means that the rest of them are thrown into landfills.
Yeah, to be precise, 92 million tons of clothes end up in landfills every year. I know that sounds like a lot and you can't really imagine what it is, but that is one entire filled garbage truck every second. Every single second. And this isn't just Shein, but the fact that they discard styles so quickly matters. It harms the environment.
Exactly. Like, Shein alone emits 6.3 million tons of carbon dioxide a year. And it's not only, they're not the only fast fashion brand. There's Romwe, Topshop, Fashion Nova, recently Temu, and fun little, this just happened super recently, but Shein and Forever 21 announced their partnership together. So now Shein can have more in-person stores and sort of help contribute to this overconsumption.
Oh, that's so fun.
So fun. And also, while we're on the topic, I also want to circle back to what I was talking about earlier. The quality of clothing that fast fashion brands make are so low, it's not quality at all. Like Shein clothes, Topshop, Romwe, Fashion Nova, Forever 21, Temu, these items are not quality. They will break so easily. And fun fact for Shein, their clothes have 18 times the allotted amount of lead in their clothing. And this increased lead exposure can lead to mood disorders, redacted sperm count, abnormal sperm activity, and even miscarriage and stillbirth in pregnant women.
That's literally everything that we've been talking about today. There's a huge crossover because when you're wearing clothes from fast fashion brands, your reproductive health is at risk.
Yeah, and this also ties into what we were talking about earlier. Because of Shein's low prices, some families are forced to shop from them simply due to economic restrictions. But now they're putting their kids, themselves, family members, pets, etc., in clothes that have the potential to lead to significant health harm. It all ties together. And Shein is just entirely unethical and honestly exploitive.
And apart from the environmental impacts, there's also massive human rights violations. The average worker works 75 hours a week and only gets 2 to 3 days off a month. 75 hours a week?
And even with that 75 hours a week, they're not even financially compensated for their work. An average worker makes 500 items a day, and they earn $2. The average worker makes 500 items a day and earns about 2 cents per item.
That's so crazy. Remember when fashion trends used to circulate every 20 years? And now it's like...
Now it's every few months.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read something that says, like, you can know what the next trendy color of the season is going to be by looking at the color of the rivers in China, because the dyes that are used in these large factories are then released into the water and pollute it.
That's ridiculous.
Entirely ridiculous.
This is an issue that every individual can contribute to solving. Start by practicing slow fashion, which emphasizes quality over quantity. It encourages consumers to invest in durable, timeless pieces and supports brands that prioritize ethical and sustainable practices.
Additionally, thrifting and buying secondhand helps reduce demand for new clothing, and it extends the lifespan of garments and reducing waste. It's a really great way to support a circular economy.
But even while thrifting, it's important to keep in mind that a lot of these clothes are the only ones that can be afforded by some low-income groups. So it's important to remember that there are nuances even to doing something that is perceived as generally sustainable. Like, thrifting oversized clothes to be fashionable reduces options for people that don't get their size in mainstream fashion brands and hence do need to buy secondhand. However, in general, clothing exchanges, recycling, and upcycling with thought, care, and intention are great ways to do your part to help the environment.
Yeah, and while individual action is super important, on the more systemic level, collective action is crucial. You know, we need to advocate for policy changes that promote transparency and accountability in the fashion industry. So, you know, supporting organizations and campaigns that drive sustainable fashion practices can also make a significant impact.
Yeah, I guess something to just think about and reflect on is keeping up with viral fashion trends and buying clothes you don't need worth the labor exploitation and environmental destruction?
Yeah, I think that's a good question that everyone should ask themselves. That's perfectly said. And, you know, moving on, another thing that we can do is recognize that environmental dangers have specific implications on women and children and promote laws that enhance reproductive health and pregnancy outcomes.
Yeah, and along a similar line, support the equal distribution of green space, walking and cycling paths, playgrounds in low-income neighborhoods to ensure that all parents have the opportunity to raise their children in healthy environments.
You know, encourage initiatives that advance gender equality and enhance the economic status of birthing people. Access to safe and inexpensive abortion and contraception should be increased, and coercive approaches to environmental issues that restrict reproductive anatomy should be rejected.
Exactly. And another thing that we can do is to demand regulatory protections and safer labor practices for people that are exposed to toxic chemicals, specifically when the majority of this workforce is dominated by low-income people and women of color.
Yeah, and lastly, for those in the United States that are in the capacity to, it is crucial to advocate for necessary changes, especially with the upcoming presidential election and local elections.
An important step is to actively encourage agencies such as the EPA, FDA, OSHA to implement and enforce regulations that demand industries to regularly test, report, and minimize the toxicity of their chemical products.
Additionally, we need to work towards dismantling or repealing existing regulations that disproportionately burden impoverished communities and communities of color with harmful environmental exposures.
Exactly. By taking this collective action, we can promote a more equitable and environmentally conscious society.
Yeah, and that's the goal. So we've talked about a lot today. So, Saina, do you have any final words that you would like to add?
I just want to end by emphasizing that no one should ever be forced to choose between raising a child in a neighborhood with toxic water and polluted air or not having a child.
Yeah, because it's not a choice.
It's not a choice at all.
Yeah.
That's all we have for you today. Stay engaged with the natural world.
And don't forget to subscribe and stay tuned for the next episode.